impeachment of Trump is really important. Will the Senate follow through with a conviction? It is my hope that they will, even if it is after he has stepped down, because it sends a message that you cannot do this. And that is really important for our future as a liberal democracy.
Episode 41 of Inside Without Now, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of the show. Tomorrow, Trump finally leaves office. A knee will be lifted off the chest of humanity, that no more does a demented bully have their finger on the nuclear trigger, that no more will there be a fascist leading the most powerful country in the world, that no more will there be a pussy grabber and white supremacist in chief. The world will rejoice when tomorrow he finally packs his bag and leaves. Despite his attempted coup, he was defeated and impeached. The air will be freshened, but the rot remains. It matters that this impeachment be thought through to conviction, that he never come back to elective office. This fascist movement is not going away, even with Trump removed. We need to reckon with how they came to power in the first place and what has been normalized over the past 4 years. There are elected officials at all levels of government who view and will act as if the Biden administration is illegitimate. And they now, as we've said before, have an armed street fighting force on call filled with vengeance. Inside and outside the halls of power, they will continue to fight for their MAGA program, brimming with white supremacy, xenophobia, and misogyny. And so we must continue to speak and act and call forth others to refuse to accept a fascist America in the name of humanity. We need to continue to deepen our understanding on how this happened and what we can do to make sure that this American fascism is driven back from all of society. In today's episode, we're sharing an interview with Dr. Jo Marie Burt to discuss Trump's attempted coup, the danger that remains, and what is needed for a thorough repudiation. Dr. Burt is a professor of political science and Latin American studies at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. She teaches and writes about political violence, human rights, and transitional justice in Latin America. She is senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America.
We're in a moment where the United States has just lived through something that has been unprecedented. Insurrection, the Capitol building being under siege. People are looking in many ways for what lessons we can learn from other parts of the world on what happened, how this happened, and how you prevent it from happening ever again. And I think that there's lessons that we should be learning from history, in particular from Peru, from Fujimori's reign, in terms of what we witnessed on January 6th, the insurrection. And I'm wondering, from what you've studied, do you think that there are similarities that lend themselves to lessons that we could be applying here?
First of all, you laid out what are the main components of what is known as transitional justice, which is a series of mechanisms that countries who've experienced long periods of authoritarian rule and or civil conflict adopt to address a legacy of wrongdoing and human rights violations. You have some kind of a commission to establish a shared set of facts and understandings of what took place, of the abuses and violations of the law that took place, what went wrong. You maybe will establish criminal courts to adjudicate responsibility, which is a form of deterrence, but it's also a form of justice for the victims, especially when there are human rights violations involved. And then there's an attempt to think through what went wrong. So what kind of changes do we need to make at the institutional level, at the level of the educational system, so such things don't happen again? That's sort of the essence of transitional justice, which has been applied across the world. It's even been applied here. There was a truth commission, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission established in Greensboro, North Carolina, I think it was in 1999, maybe, to examine a case of racialized violence by the Ku Klux Klan with the kind of complicity of the local police force that had left several people dead and prompted this local inquiry into why this happened, what went wrong, why no one was ever held accountable, and how to resolve the divisions that continued to exist from this massacre, which happened in 1979. So it's been applied at the very local level in the US as well. But yeah, I do think there are lessons that can be learned from looking at other parts of the world. And Peru is a really good case because Peru, at least in terms of modern politics, the original self coup, Fiona Hill wrote about it and has talked about it on different programs. The original modern self coup was invented by Alberto Fujimori, who was actually elected president in 1990 in Peru at a time when Peru was experiencing massive political violence by two armed insurgent groups, the Shining Path and the MRTA. The economy was in absolute free fall. And he took power. He was an unknown, a political outsider. He appealed to people based on this anti-politics rhetoric, sort of railing against, right, the traditional political parties, railing against a system that was corrupt, that was not taking care of the average Peruvian. Sounds familiar, right? So he won the elections fair and square. And then about a year and a half into his term, and in Peru at that time, there was no consecutive re-election, he carried out what was termed at the time a self-coup, an autogolpe, in which he shut down Congress. He took over control of the judiciary with the backing of the armed forces and ruled for the next several years. Now, he was forced to step back because of international pressure to a certain extent. He suspended the 1979 Constitution, which was a constitution that had been written after decades of military government, military intervention in politics. There was a constitutional convention. All political parties participated and wrote a new constitution. It was very democratic, very open-ended, and he suspended the Constitution. So when he was pressured, interestingly enough, by the United States and others, the Organization of American States and others, he decided to hold new elections for Congress so he would get sort of some of the international heat off of him. But it was completely changed. It became a Congress made by and for Fujimori. His followers ended up getting a majority in Congress, which they didn't have before. And basically, they became an arm of the executive branch. So the idea of separation of powers, which is so central to democracy, was eviscerated. And of course, as I mentioned already, he controlled the courts. What he did was he fired any judges at all levels who were not supportive of him and his actions. And he put in place loyalists as temporary judges, meaning if they dared challenge his rule, they would just get fired. So he had a very foolproof way of controlling the judiciary. And unfortunately, the military backed him because there was this insurgency going on and the military really wanted a blank check to do what they felt was needed to be done to end the insurgency, which was essentially torture, mass force disappearance, massacres, and arbitrary detention. And so that's what you started seeing. Oh, and they wrote a new constitution, which was a constitution also tailor-made for Mr. Fujimori. I mean, there's a lot of things about this constitution that are problematic, but most important in that constitution was a clause allowing him to run for re-election. So they lifted the previous ban on immediate re-election. So Fujimori was able to run in 1995 for a second time. In the end, I mean, he ruled for a total of 10 years and fled the country at the end of 2000 because of the revelations of mass corruption. It wasn't because of the human rights abuses, I'm sorry to say, but it was because of, I mean, that was garnering him increasing levels of—
It was bribery, right? Or something.
It was like bribery and abuse of power. So for example, the video that really was, that sealed the deal was a video of an opposition congressman who'd just been elected in the 2000 elections, receiving a suitcase full of cash from Fujimori's chief security advisor, Vladimiro Montesinos, who was a former military official, but had been kicked out of the military. In fact, he served a short time in jail because of his questionable actions back in the 70s, I think it was. And he was basically bribing this opposition congressman to leave his party and join Fujimori's party, because in the 2000 elections, Fujimori's party no longer had a majority. And they needed a majority to continue that form of rule in which the Congress was literally a rubber stamp for the executive. So they were trying to regain their majority in Congress through bribery. And that was the kind of thing that sealed the deal and forced him eventually to flee the country. And he went to Japan, which is the home of his parents. Japan gave him citizenship, essentially making it nearly impossible for Peru to extradite him. Although Peru did try, they filed extradition requests to Japan. The Japanese government basically ignored the request until at some point it seemed like Fujimori, he was running for Senate in Japan, which is very bizarre. And apparently, I don't know all the details, but apparently he started to run afoul of some of the more powerful players in Japan. And he left Japan for Chile in 2005. Now, there were new elections coming up in Peru in 2006. So he was advised by one of his close advisors that Chile would be a good place for him to organize his campaign for re-election, to stand for the 2006 elections. Only his advisor clearly did not understand the moment that we were living in, which is a moment in which human rights accountability has become a global affair. You'll recall in 1998, when Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, left the country and went to London for back surgery, he was arrested and he would have been extradited to stand trial in Spain for torture, except that the British government decided to send him home on humanitarian grounds. So there are a series of international laws that say if someone is wanted for grave crimes, international crimes, you have the power in certain circumstances to pursue prosecution in your own country. It doesn't have to be their home country. So there's a whole story there about how this all happens. But ultimately, Fujimori is extradited back to Peru in 2007, and he's put on trial, and he's convicted for human rights abuses, for corruption, and for abuse of authority. And he's sentenced to the maximum of 25 years. Interestingly, he was not prosecuted for his role in the self-coup, but 10 of his cabinet members were. And I think this is where the Peru case is especially interesting. I mean, it is important that the former head of state was prosecuted for human rights abuses, for corruption, and for other crimes. And I was a trial monitor. I participated as an observer in that trial and wrote and reported about it. But it's also interesting to note that in 2007, just shortly before the Fujimori trial began, 10 members of his cabinet were in power at the time of the coup, were convicted and sentenced for their participation in the violation of the constitutional order. And the one cabinet member, I think he was the head of the cabinet, Alfonso de los Héroes, he resigned immediately after the coup happened. He said he didn't know about it, he opposed it, and he resigned. And so he was not prosecuted. So it just shows you how individual actions do matter. But they were held accountable. They weren't given long prisons. Only one was given a 10-year sentence. The other ones were given 3 or 4 years, very short, reduced sentences, which I find problematic, but at least they were sanctioned. And so to me, that holds up a light that if there's political will, it is possible to hold people accountable for serious crimes, whether they're crimes like violating the constitutional order, as was the case with the Fujimori autogolpe, or whether it's human rights violations, or whether it's corruption or other similar related crimes. Peru's not terribly known for having a strong, dynamic judiciary. For 10 years before that, the judiciary was very weak, easily manipulated. And then, of course, under the Fujimori regime, it was completely manipulated. But a series of reforms were put in place to ensure that, right, that the courts were what they're supposed to be, impartial, independent, autonomous.
What danger do you see still remaining from what you have studied in Latin America after an incident like what we saw? What are the factors that you look to see whether danger or the threat has passed?
Well, I think there's a couple of different levels that we have to look at. One is the institutional level, what the institutional response to this is. Then the other is a broader, maybe societal level response. So let's talk about the institutional first. And I said this in other interviews, accountability is of utmost importance here. Those responsible need to be held accountable. So we're seeing the ongoing arrest of dozens of individuals who participated in the breach of the U.S. Capitol, some of whom are responsible not only for desecrating that space, for trespassing, for, you know, making a big mess, but for deaths. You know, we all know that 5 people were killed. One Capitol police official was bludgeoned to death by a fire extinguisher. I mean, this is really unthinkable. So people need to be held accountable for those actions, but not just what we call in international law parlance, the material authors, the people who actually committed the crime, but also the intellectual authors, the people who were behind the crimes, who facilitated the crimes, who incited or directed the crimes to happen. No one is going to say that President Trump told a supporter to bludgeon a U.S. Capitol Police official to death. But he did incite them in several ways by lying about the results of the election, by urging them to march on the Capitol, by trying to undermine the results of the election through those calls to those Georgia state officials that we've all read in horror about, using the language of violence and vindictiveness, to the point where this is another one of those lingo things that political scientists like me use. I mean, I think the part of the Republican Party that is decidedly Trumpist has become a disloyal opposition. We use that term to typically in a democracy, people agree to play by the rules of the game, understanding that sometimes they win and sometimes they lose. And a peaceful transfer of power is one of the most important inventions of democracy, right? Because otherwise you have coups and counter coups, putches, assassinations, all kinds of things like that, that we see in authoritarian systems or totalitarian systems. So that peaceful transfer of power is central to democracy. It's a very important thing. What happens when one or more of the parties no longer agree to play by the rules of the game? And I think that's what we've seen over these years with Trump, the Trumpist wing of the Republican Party. Some people say that is the Republican Party now. I'm not 100% sure that that's the case. And I'm hopeful that it's not the case. And then maybe there will be some, I don't know what to call it.
Splits,
purging, rethinking what the Republican Party is and what its role to democracy is. Because if you are elected into office and then you go up and say those elections were fraudulent, well, they can't be fraudulent only for some of the elections and not for the others. And that's ludicrous. So that's the big lie that we're all hearing. And I love that phrase because I think it helps encapsulate what we've been living through for the past 4 years, a series of big lies. I mean, this is the big lies, but we've been experiencing a series of lies that have led us to this moment. At the institutional level, will we hold those responsible, the material authors, but also the intellectual authors responsible? I mean, the impeachment of Trump is really important. Will the Senate follow through with a conviction? It is my hope that they will, even if it is after he has stepped down, because it sends a message that you cannot do this. And that is really important for our future as a liberal democracy. What about the Republicans who aided and abetted, not just the protesters, because there apparently are some who did that, but Trump and the big lie? How are they to be held accountable? Can they be held accountable? And so I think it's important to pursue that. I think it's important to look at the institutional breakdowns that made this all possible. But then there's the social level. There's this mistrust of government. There's this mistrust of the media that, of course, Trump has fomented, but I don't think it originated with him. Millions of supporters of Trump who believe everything that he says. What are we to do with that? So there has to be a reckoning with that level of a broader sort of societal division. It's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this and I don't know the answer, but I'll just sort of throw it out there. I remember when I was, I don't know, a teenager, maybe a little bit older, there was a whole campaign to promote truth in advertising. Do you remember that? Truth in advertising. So if you're going to say
labeling and things like that as well.
Right. Yeah. Right. If I'm going to promote Advil and I'm going to say Advil cures headaches, there has to be demonstrated proof that Advil actually does cure headaches. I can't say Advil cures breast cancer because we know that that's not true. So why can't we have advertising in our media universe? Why can't we have truth in advertising in our politics? How do we hold people accountable who are consistently lying to us for their own personal gain or political expediency? Now, elections is one way to hold people accountable, but we know that it's not sufficient and it may not be the only way. So I think we have to think that through. And I don't necessarily have all the answers as to how to do it. I do think education, well, I'm an educator, education is critical in this. But again, it's not the only thing. And that is clearly a mid to long-term solution. We have to think of other ways to address this broader social question. So maybe an inquiry. I've been working with a bunch of colleagues who work on transitional justice around the world to think about whether transitional justice is applicable in the United States in relation to our history of racialized violence and institutionalized racism. And there are many localities around the country that are beginning to do something similar to what the Greensboro, North Carolina Truth Commission did several years ago, which I mentioned at the outset of our conversation. And Representative Barbara Lee and Senator Cory Booker have introduced and supported legislation to create a national truth and racial reconciliation commission that would do that, which I think is absolutely very important, critical. But do we maybe need to do something similar about Trumpism, about the lies of Trumpism, about the big lie, not only about the election, but about all of it. And should that be a government inquiry? You know, this Senate inquiry? No, we did a Senate inquiry after 9/11. We did a Senate inquiry after the torture memos. Those are important. But maybe it needs to be bigger than, or because it implicates members of our government. Maybe it needs to be notables and citizens who are independent, who participate, you know, people of grand esteem and impeccable credentials, who could be the ones leading this investigation. I mean, I do think that the Congress certainly has the right and the duty to investigate what its members did to facilitate what happened on January 6th. But maybe we also need to think bigger about this broader landscape that has created this moment where a large number of our fellow citizens believe that Trump won the election with no proof. And they're perfectly willing to storm the Capitol and possibly murder people in pursuit of what they believe to be the truth. That's really deeply problematic. That's not going to go away. Right? Even if they prosecute Trump, even if Trump disappears from the political landscape, this is going to continue. And the connection between all of this and white supremacy and racism is something that also has to be grappled with front and center.
You had said something and I had written down white supremacy question mark, because I think that there's delusions and then there's the self-delusions that this tremendous group with these false grievances, the false victimhood, I think there's a connection very much between the conspiracy peddling of the stolen election and the false victimhood of what's happening to white men. I think that there's a connection there. And who were the votes that didn't count? Who were the peoples whose voice meant nothing? Who are today?
It's not on anybody, right? That yeah. The language and the focus of discounting certain votes were in areas like Georgia, where a huge percentage of the population voting are African Americans.
I mean, all the states that they looked at, the cities that they were looking at, Philadelphia, Detroit, it didn't take a scholar, an expert of anything to say, wait, what was the racial makeup of that voting block and how would that voting block have voted? It makes me want to pull my hair out. And you have the QAnon lady, I know that that's not what I should call her, tweeting out an MLK quote when she had no problem overturning the votes of millions of Black people. It's so disturbing. I guess my last question for you, from what you've studied in Latin America, what does it look like after liberal governments return to power? What you talked about the need for that justice and accountability aspect. What else have you observed amongst the people and just the everyday experience of people? For instance, could look at Peru or elsewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's challenging, right? Because these are societies that have experienced tremendous chaos and instability. There are tremendous social, economic, political, and racial or ethnic divisions sometimes. Peru is a really good example of that. Institutions are weakened, not necessarily like I mentioned a moment ago about the judiciary having been, you know, thoroughly gutted under Fujimori. So how do you rebuild a judiciary so that it does what it's supposed to do, adjudicate the law fairly and impartially? To me, one of the biggest challenges is the divisions in society. Let me talk briefly about Peru. And this is common for many countries in Latin America that experience either authoritarian military rule like Argentina or Chile under Pinochet, and Peru, Guatemala, El Salvador that experience internal armed conflicts. They had truth commissions, national. They were government-created truth commissions, but they weren't run by the government. They became these autonomous bodies wherein well-known, well-respected individuals pursued an inquiry into what happened, why it happened, and what should we do about it. So the Peruvian Truth and Reconciliation Commission conducted a two and a half year study of what caused the violence, what caused human rights violations, what caused the authoritarian government of Fujimori, and how should Peru address this. And so there were a series of recommendations from prosecuting the most responsible to providing reparations for victims, both financial reparations, but also symbolic reparations, memorial sites, healthcare, especially important for poor indigenous people who were about 75% of the victims.
Was there anything particularly that they did for the women who had been impacted by the mass forced sterilization or?
Well, that's a sore subject for Peru because the Truth Commission determined that the Fujimori government in the early to mid 1990s enacted a reproductive policy that essentially was mass forced sterilization of women and some men, primarily indigenous people in rural areas. And the numbers range, in general, people believe that 200,000 to 300,000 women, mostly women and some men, were forcibly sterilized. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission decided that this was not a crime connected to the internal armed conflict, even though it's completely part of the authoritarian government of the Fujimori regime, number one. And number two, it's clearly a crime against humanity. And they did not include it in their inquiry. So as you can imagine, a lot of people were very upset about this. To this day, there are feminist organizations and human rights organizations that continue to mobilize for reparations and for justice for these women. There have been, I am not kidding you, I think there have been four attempts to prosecute different individuals. But recently, this is very new and I'm very hopeful about it. Fujimori himself, and I think three of his ministers, including two of his ministers of health, have been indicted. And a trial was actually supposed to start last week, but the judge postponed the hearing because there weren't translators for the women who are native Quechua speakers. So that was an oversight on the part of the court that is unacceptable. But I mean, remember that this all happened in the mid to late 90s. So we're talking 20 to 25 years ago that these women are still waiting for some modicum of justice. There are also many women who were the victims of sexual violence. And there's only been one conviction in a sexual violence case in Peru. There is an ongoing case right now. Guatemala has been much better at prosecuting sexual violence. But again, the number of prosecutions in relation to the number of victims is, you know, minuscule. But exemplary convictions do matter because they send a message that this kind of behavior is not acceptable. You know, for example, in one of the trials in Guatemala, the sexual violence and sexual slavery case, the court ordered the Ministry of Defense to review training materials that are used to train soldiers and to inform them of their duty to respect human rights, to not sexually violate women. I mean, you know, to understand what the rules of engagement are. And that's important, right? Because hopefully in the future, this means that military officials will behave differently. So that is, I do think that even when they are a handful of convictions, when they are exemplary, as they were in the Sepulcarco and other cases, it sends a message. And that's important, I think. So hopefully we'll see some exemplary convictions here of material and intellectual authors. But that depends on us. I always tell my students this. We have a role. Our representatives work for us. Right? We can write them. We can call them. We can organize. We can protest. Right? We have voice. We can make a difference. I mean, we can sometimes sit on our butts and do it on the computer, but sometimes we need to get off our butts and go in the streets and demand change. So it depends. A lot of that depends on us as well.
You can follow Dr. Burt at Joe M. A. Burt. Thanks for listening. All who have been shaken and awakened by the events of this past month, join the Refuse Fascism community of resistors coming from a range of perspectives who recognize that America's Nazi problem is not going away and that it must be defeated through mass, nonviolent action. Our podcast will continue as Refuse Fascism, bringing together people from various viewpoints to dig into all that this raises. So be sure to subscribe for the latest and rate and review to help us reach more listeners. Go to refusefascism.org to read and sign the pledge to the people of the world and join the network ready to act. While you're there, I hope you'll click the donate button to support the show or Venmo refuse-fascism. I want to end today's episode by sharing a tweet from Anil Dashi. Anil is a tech entrepreneur and writer, and he wrote something that I think we all need to take to heart and act on. Tomorrow, a lot of people are going to say, we made it, we survived 4 years. And it's vitally important to remember that so many didn't make it. We have to be their voices and seek justice and accountability for the brutal harms that have been visited upon so many. Thanks as always to my co-producers of this podcast, Richie Marini and Lena Thorne. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Trump Pence, out now. Stay safe, not silent. And I'll see you in the streets soon.